that one. And I always did the Jack Rock song. Rick's responsible for that. Rick loves Jack Rock. I think if he could have had a love affair with him, he would have. He came close to it.
Been aware of Jack Rock. I've never heard about him.
Oh yeah, right. They're a legend. Well, you know, it didn't start here. You'd think the Pittston came up with it during the 80s, but they didn't. It's been a long...
Medieval, they didn't call them cowboys. They used to just call them...
Yeah, and what the road jacks is what they called them in... Australia, someplace. I can't remember where it was.
The Mexican-American family called them Miguelitos, little Michael.
But... here they were called Jack Rocks because that's what they look like jacks that you play with. Only they've only got 4 points on them, but no matter how you pitch them, they're going to land with a point up. You take 2 nails, cut the head off of them at an angle, and then bend them at each one of them at a 90-degree angle and cross them and weld them in the middle. And they were called salt and pepper during the Pittston strike. And the word was that you better not go on this side or that side, wherever, you know, because there's salt and pepper there. We've already salt and peppered it. And one guy in Bethel that was in charge of one of Bethel's picket sites didn't listen to him, and he jumped off of when the trucks came out of the holler, hauling non-union coal, he jumped off on the wrong side, and one of them went through the middle of his foot, and he spent the rest of the strike on crutches. I said, that's not very good, out captain of the picket side. It was funny, though. Everything was funny. Even the goon guards with the guns were funny then.
Looking back at it. You know, the Union women saved them when their truck went in the ditch? Remember that story?
No.
Linda Grimmett, man, there were some scabs there driving the truck and it turned over, and they ran down and rescued them.
Yeah, the water was up. And the creek was up. That was up there at Stalin.
Run Creek is deep here.
Yeah, okay. And but yeah, they got the scabs out of the truck and you know, I saw Linda not very long ago.
Really?
Yeah, she was working down here up there on Big Creek at her daughter's business, and she wouldn't even talk about the strike. It affected her that much. I mean, a lot of people, it just tore them all to pieces, tore their lives up. Family, homes busted up, and they just couldn't handle the stress, and they just went crazy. And we had, Bethel had a lot of problems, too. I can't, you know, say anything bad about that, because he was gone all the time, and I had 3 girls at the house trying to take care of them, and he wasn't getting strike benefits at that point. And I was having to work at Hardee's to try to get money. One thing food stamps doesn't pay for is laundry detergent and electric bill and all that. And the girls were, 2 of the girls were in sports. And one of our baby girl, had kind of like a nervous breakdown. She missed school so much and she wouldn't go back. And she fought me when I tried to get her to go back. Of course, you know, that all ended. But still, I mean, it puts you through hell. And it was a hard thing. There were, except for that part of it, I'd go back and do it again.
Oh, yeah.
it gets in your blood. Everybody I've talked to that was involved in that strike, I mean, it was like, God, where did those days go to? And where did all the people go to? But, yeah, Rick got me to write one day more, and he said, you know, there's never been a song written about a Jack Rock. And he said, I think I'd like to hear a song written about a Jack Rock. So I couldn't write. I mean, how do you write a song about a Jack Rock? A song. So I wrote, and he named it. He named it Talking Jack Rock Blues. And I wrote that one. And then Picket Line Ladies. Only I was talking to people. I tried to get an idea about women on a picket line, you know, because I wasn't allowed to walk picket lines. If I wanted to, I would have. If I wanted to go over their feelings. But the men, and that I worked with came to me, some of them did, and asked me to stay away from the picket lines because he was like the stability, and if he lost it, then he said, we'll lose the strike. If he loses it on the picket line, we will lose the strike. And so I stayed away, except the day that Howard Green and, what was his name, Bernard Evans, got arrested. I was up there, but they didn't have anybody. There's two preachers that came from down south with a letter in their pocket, supporting the union side of the strike. And they didn't have anybody to take them up to the picket site so they could give them the letter. And so they called me and asked me if I would. And I said, you know, you all asked me to stay away from up there. Well, you don't have to go actually on the picket site. You just take them up there, and then you can turn around and come back home. Well, anybody knows me knows that ain't going to happen. So I took them up there and got out, and Bethel said, you need to go. You need to get out of here. What? And he said, Elaine, you need to go home. I said, why? He said, just go, and I'll tell you later. Well, I was going back to my car, and about that time, here the trucks come out of the holler. And, I mean, it was bad. It was really bad. And Bernard and the whole thing was set up to see what would happen. And probably set up so somebody could go to jail. And they took them to jail, arrested them, took them to jail. And those preachers, when they got there, they make the empty pockets, you know, when they're with you and stuff. All they had in their pockets were the letters from those preachers from down south supporting. I mean, two Methodist preachers, I think they were from two Methodist congregations down there. And that's all they had in their pockets. I said, that really looked bad. I mean, these big bad murderers walking the picket line up there didn't have anything but a letter from two churches in their pockets. But, yeah, and so I didn't go back up there anymore. And they told me at the office, no matter who they needed to take up there, they wouldn't call me to take them up there. I said, I guarantee you something's going to happen. But see, we didn't know that was going to be one of the days they were going to try to haul coal. We had no idea. And the office didn't know either. I don't know. I think all the men were out of the office, which would have been clue one, you know, for me if I'd been working up there. All the men are out of the office. Something's going on. You better wait and let me get a hold of them first. But, I mean, you can look back on it, hindsight's 20/20. And then the Picket Line Ladies song, I mean, I went and asked people about, and one guy gave me a song about women on the picket line, and it was like Peyton Place or a soap opera. I said, I ain't writing about, the women that I know aren't like that. I said, I'm not writing that stuff. That's nasty. So... Well, he had this big long page. I mean, it was like a legal size paper about women on the picket lines. And I said, I wouldn't even read all that, let alone writing, singing that stuff. But, you know, everybody started knocking on the door and calling on the phone and getting me to come here and there and sing. And I traveled all over the place. And then they called from a festival that they were having up in Canada and wanted me to come up there and sing. And I thought it was because of the union stuff. But in addition to doing the union stuff, when I would sing that, I would also sing the mountain stuff, the traditional music that I grew up listening to. And that's what they wanted me for. And I did that, plus the union stuff up there. And then they wanted me to do gospel, and I did that too. And it just started a whole ball of wax rolling, whole snowball rolling downhill. Oh, yeah, later. You were responsible for that one too.
No, I didn't write it.
No, but you had me to write it. Later's got its hands in its pockets about the old idea of the, who was it?
IWW.
Yeah, the IWW.
This is not in the good place.
Like throwing.
Like if you flavor for the thing, nothing would happen if everybody just stopped.
If they just walked step back and put their hands in their pockets, you know, what would happen? And I wrote a song about that. And all of them went over real well. Everyone that he had me write went over real well. He had some really good ideas.
And
the one day more was Ravenswood. But Ravenswood was like, during the 16 months that Pittston was out, or right at the tail end of the Pittston thing.
Yeah, shortly after that's when I went up there right after it started, and they didn't want us to talk about it. And then a year later, I got the call.
Yeah, it's their, they tried using jack rocks in their steel trucks. Their loaded down steel trucks were flattening the jack rocks. And I said, well, y'all got to look at it this way. A load of steel weighs more than a load of coal. The trucks are bigger, the steel is heavier, and it's going to be different. So Bethel got the idea that you could use 20 penny nails, those little short, fat nails. And that's what they did, and they worked.
Now, see, I really never used them to look around, but I do suggest pipe cleaners, just a natural thing.
He was the historian through all the whole thing. Rick was. There was a lot of women on the picket line. Pittston was really the turning point for that. They'd done it in a previous strike, but they swore they'd never go back again because they were treated so badly. We created an organization called Friends and Family of UNWA because we wanted to disconnect ourselves from the union because, according to our historian here, families can do things in a strike that union members cannot, because union members are bound by law and family members are not. So it got to the point, we were good at what we did. And I told them when we first started, and we told the men too, when we, you know, we said, we got to check with you all, we got to listen to you all, because we got to know what you're doing so we can do what we do. And I said, but we're not going to just make coffee and cupcakes and carry it to the picket lines. And, of course, we did cook on the picket lines. They had, and that was another plus, you know, the men didn't have to go out and get their food or anything. They cooked it right there on the picket lines. And we wore our camo just like they did. I didn't do the picket line stuff, but a lot of other women did.
How did you cook?
Well, they had hot plates set up, and because they'd have electric. They had electric at those places. And they kept coffee made, and, of course, they weren't there all night. You know, they'd go home in the evenings and then come back the next day. So same thing all over. We marched with the men. And the women up at Slab Fork, up in that area, stood out in front of them trucks and climbed on them, which was really stupid, I think. But, you know, it was our lives we were talking about. What that strike was about. A lot of people think it was just about higher wages, but it wasn't. We still don't have a guaranteed pension plan. And I think recently they started the wheels rolling to get it guaranteed. 50s pensioners do, but the 70s pensioners don't. And our health care, they can yank it from us anytime. And that's what they're trying to do right now.
We've gone to some of the bankruptcy things before. Recently, the Patriot Road.
They called me to get me to come and just actually they want me to sing for them because, you know, it kind of gets people's blood boiling, but, and that's what I do. But in doing that, I meet a lot of people and I talk to them about what happened before and then I learn from them. And they, not only the Patriot workers, but look what they did to the ones in Huntington, sounds like a telephone company. I can't remember. But, I mean, those men. No. It's, maybe some of the telephone companies. No, that, I didn't do anything with that. This was before that. It was a coal company. But it sounds like a telephone company. I can't remember. And they They took their benefits. They didn't have anything left. And they said, well, we'll set up a program where we can retrain you. 58 years old, you can retrain all you want to. People aren't going to hire that man. He's too close to retirement age. And that's what happened with Pittston when they shut down a lot of the mines at Pittston when they reorganized and did all of that. It was to get rid of the older men who were close to retirement age so they wouldn't have to pay their retirement, you know. And these young workers that are out there working now don't see that. They're going to get the screws put to them just like we did to us, you know.
Think about the new, with the new situation.
Mm-hmm. It's different. It's different because they got smart. I mean, the companies did. And there's not as many workers out there to stand up and fight. You're finding workers on the side of the companies now. And they've convinced everybody that the environmental laws are what's wrong with the industry. No, the coal industry's been on the demise for a long time, a lot of years. We saw it in Pittston, and it's been progressing ever since. And the thing that's wrong with the coal industry are the greedy company people at the top that run the whole thing. I've tried to avoid calling parasites, but that's what they are. And, I mean, it goes back, way back to in the, I guess, 30s and 40s when they called them greedy parasites. That's what they are. They're not making any less money. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, you just need to go back and look at your history, but you can understand where the miners are coming from. They're scared to death they're not going to be able to provide for their families. But you need to look at both sides of that coin. I mean, it's something I feel really, really, I get really hot about because people, I don't know if they want to take the shortcut to getting what they want or if they just don't want to get out there and hoof it and fight for it. It's easier to believe somebody that's going to come in and tell you a nice story with real pretty icing on top of it. What?
You got to think about, like, the serious sample. You know what I mean? Like, the whole cycle right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So after
Pittston
and
Freeland
Bridge,
mm-hmm.
and
Freeland
Bridge,
mm-hmm.
and what did you get involved in? And then doing some water and stuff?
Well, that was with my work.
Okay.
And, because of my work and with the union, I got offered a job with the West Virginia Organizing Project, and I worked with them two different times for several years as a community organizer. And that was mainly over in Pigeon Creek. And I don't know if people are familiar with the movie Moving Mountains and the book that Penny Lowe. Moving Mountains, and it's about Patricia Bragg's struggle to get good water for her community over there in Pye and in the Pye and Barney area. And I was the organizer that went in to organize that group because they would wake up like at 2 o'clock in the morning and aim to go get a drink of water, and they wouldn't have anything but mud to come out of their pipes. And it was the blasting that was doing it. And so we started that. Well, it ended up in court, and we were a community organizing group, and we did the direct action organizing, which we went in, our organizers went in and taught people how to organize their own community and who to go to and go through proper channels of getting stuff done. And I'm not saying lawsuits is not a proper channel, but that should be a last resort because you should try to work it out first. But you can't work with the coal companies. I'm sorry. There is no working with coal companies. And but it ended up in court. And Bragg versus Robinson. And so Penny Loeb worked for U.S. News and World Report then. And she came down to do a story on that. And ended up staying 2 years and wrote a book about it. And then people showed interest in a movie. And she wrote the script for the movie, and the movie was released just last year. And I went to terrible with names of places. Oak Hill. And did a performance up there. They were showing in their little amphitheater up there. They were showing the movie. And there was a group of young kids that came to us. And they were just so enthused about that what we did in that movie, because Kayla was with us. You know, Kayla's grown, got her own family now, but she was just 9 years old then, Trisha's daughter. And she was 9 years old and spoke before Congress about the water rights over there. I mean, we empowered a lot of people through that, but I'm telling you, Trish was amazing. She was just like me, a stay-at-home housewife that asked her husband permission for everything. And she ended up going to college and graduating and working outside the home and providing for the family and everything. I think now she's back to the house just being grandma and going around promoting the movie.
Is the movie good? Yeah.
They
look like you, right?
No. A lady called Tina Alexis Allen played me, and she's now on the weekly TV program Outsiders. She plays Shern on The Outsiders. And I asked her if playing the part of me in the movie helped her with that bow leg. And she said, oh, yeah. She said, I didn't have to work very hard at all. Because it's in the mountains of Kentucky. That's where the people are from that are in that show, that the show's about. And she said, oh, yeah. I had down before I went down there. She said, before I tried to get the job. And she was good enough. They'd asked her back for the second season. So she's doing season two of it, too. And
is it on Netflix?
No. I got a copy of it. Just recently got my copy of it. They don't have them out for sale yet, but they're working with somebody now to try to get them out for sale. And that was the good thing. It tells pretty true to the right story, too. And our relationship with the DEP and, you know, through the work of the West Virginia Organizing Project. And but then she got involved with Mountain State Justice because they hadn't filed a lawsuit. They wouldn't have gotten anything if they hadn't. We would have gotten some stuff, but not nearly as much as they did through that lawsuit. And it raised awareness for a lot of people. But, I mean, the people in her community that believed what the company was saying instead of believing her, you know, it just amazed me. You wonder how people can be so blind. But desperation will make people do just about anything. And that's what they were worried about then, too. It's what the people are worried about now. And I'm worried for them because they're putting some of the mines back to work. But, I mean, it's too little too late. And we needed to have been looking at alternative energy sources for a long time. And I'm not saying shut down the mines. I've never been against mining. My husband's a miner. His dad was a miner, and his dad was a miner. And, I mean, worked in the mines. They were what we call gouge hole mines, independent mines. But still, that's what they did. And it's made a good living for us, and I wouldn't have it shut down for anything. But it's on its way out. I mean, people aren't going to do it that way anymore. And I think the music that I did, and not just the songs that I wrote and the struggle songs that other people had written, but the traditional music of the mountains, it's soul music. It's music. It's people pouring out their heart and soul on a piece of paper and then putting music to it. And it's stories about people and about their feelings. Even the country music that I know, and I do country also, is the stuff of the 50s and 60s where they actually wrote about love and home. A lot of it was cheating, but there's a lot of cheating going on during them days. And you know, alcohol was a big problem back then, and a lot of those stories are about that. And I mean, it's just a big part of telling the story and a big part of the history and people's feelings. And I think they know that. When they call me to get me to come someplace and sing, it's usually that's what they want. I had a group from, oh, that was when they called me from up in Canada, wanted me to come up there and do that festival up there. They said, I asked them something about if they could have a guitar up there for me because I didn't want to take it on the plane. And she said, you don't even have to bring your guitar. She said, we'll get one for you, but you don't even have to get on stage with a guitar. She said, shoot, people just want to sit there and listen to you talk. And I said, no, I don't think I can talk for 45 minutes now. And I learned since. I've learned since then I can. But it means a lot to people, and especially the traditional stuff. They love, Amazing Grace and How Great Thou Art were two of the most requested songs when I'd go to sing for a union activity or a work-related activity. They wanted me to sing Amazing Grace and How Great Thou Art.
I'm the angel band.
Sometimes I do.
Yeah, could you talk a little bit about what traditional stuff you play?
What do you mean, the types of songs I do?
Yeah,
I do bluegrass, I do old country. All musicians that have influenced me. Patsy Cline, first of all. Loretta Lynn, of course. And I usually sing men's songs because there's more of them to choose from. And that the old singers, George Jones, Merle Haggard, Bobby Bear, you know, people like that. I mean, just about everybody that's on the Nashville Channel now, as, you know, they're old and fat and gray-headed, sitting there just picking a laptop guitar and singing, those are the ones that have influenced me. Rosemary Clooney, I love that woman. Patti Page, I love listening to their music. And I got to meet some of the women in blues, and before I really actually knew their work, and I've learned about it since then. Mahalia Jackson, I always wanted to get up in front of a bunch of people and sing a gospel song like Mahalia Jackson. Of course, I've never been able to do that, but I mean, I just, you know, the people, to me, they really felt their music, and we all know George Jones and Merle Haggard lived their music, and they wrote about it. And I just think that's the best way to say something if you've got something to say. And the very best way to do that is a cappella. Of course, I go to the non-instrumental church of Christ, and that's what we've always done. We've never had an instrument in church in our worship service. But I still pick my guitar and sing the gospel songs outside of that. And
the one thing, just the work you're doing now with kids kind of circles back. I mean, we were talking about years ago, but now you're really teaching kids to play and sing and write music. Is that right?
Not write music. We write songs.
Yeah.
And, I mean, when Kate McComas first came to me and asked me if I would do that, it's an endowment from the Clay Center that pays West Virginia artists to go into after-school programs and teach kids in after-school programs about our music. And they don't really care if you teach them music or not. They just want you to teach them the songs, because what Mr. Clay had realized was that that's a lost art. The kids are not learning Old Ann Tucker and Oh Susanna and those songs that even go back further than that, the mountain songs that people wrote and sang when they were using machete to cut down the bushes so they could build a shack, you know, build a cabin on it and work the land. The people that moved into this part of the country were the very poorest of the poor. And they were, some of them came here because they were starving to death in their own country. And it just all that different nationalities and all the different types of music blended together into an Appalachian musical feast, I think. I mean, we all think the guitar was the first instrument that was played in Appalachia. It wasn't. And, you know, learning things like that and then how hard it was on those people. They wrote songs about what they were going through, and the men would actually write the songs, but the women would sing them. They would learn them and sing them. simply because the men had to be out working and the women were at home. They didn't have time to sit down and learn them, but they, while they worked, they could sing them, and that's what they did. And that the kids don't know that part of their history. They don't know anything about traditional music. They don't even, when I first started teaching in the music camp over at Big Ugly, those kids didn't even know how to listen to music. I challenged them, you bring your music to me, because I would have them listen to a CD that they liked and then sing me a song off of it. They couldn't do it. They hollered. I mean, they just hollered the words. There was no tune, no beat, no nothing. And so I taught them. I taught them where their voice comes from, and I said, this is important. If you're going to try to get a message out to somebody, you've got to listen first. So we had a whole, we had two or three days there where we just practiced listening, and they were singing by the end of the week. But that's what Mr. Clay had seen. You know, that was being lost. Women weren't teaching their kids those old songs anymore, and nobody was. So they hired me to teach them old mountain songs, not the music. It didn't matter about the music, just teach them the songs. And that's what I started doing. But it turned into, we made our own instruments. We made drums and we made shakers and we wrote skits. And you saw kids that wouldn't even talk to you when they first started class coming up to you and saying, Miss Elaine, I think we ought to do a song like this. You know, and that's just, it's just so rewarding. It's there for all of them, but you just got to get a hold of it and develop it. And that's what Mr. Clay saw, and that's what I'm doing now. I go, I've only got one school that I'm working at, but I work for the Clay Center over at Big Ugly, and through the Clay Center over at Big Ugly, and they, I work with the after-school kids teaching them. Now I'm teaching them songs that they wrote in that Patchwork Dreams project that they had over there, where Heidi Muller worked with them to write songs about Big Ugly and Hearts Creek and the area and the life here. And they went into the grade schools and for in 2004 and 2006, I think, or maybe 2007, and worked with kids and wrote all kinds of songs about the life. A lot of, just about every song I've taught the kids, been teaching the kids over there, has a line in it about a four-wheeler. I mean, that is a big part of the life over there, because it's so rural, you know, you can get around better on a four-wheeler than you can on those roads, than you can a regular car. And so it's sad that there's not more programs like that around, because we need to know about the music. And they're trying to cut the performing arts out of schools. That's a big mistake. That the performing arts is a way for kids to see, you know, I may not be able to play ball. I may not be able to jump the highest of anybody else. I may not make straight A's. But, hey, I can write a song. And I can sing it. I can let people know. I've got a voice. I can let people know what I'm thinking. And it's being lost. It's being totally lost. And was an effort by Mr. Clay to keep it going. That's what the program was intended to do. And I think it's done it so far. I've worked with them for 6 years. The program's been active longer than that. But I've worked with them for 6 years, and I think I've gotten more out of it than they have.
Well, and music is a lifelong skill.
Mm-hmm. Well, when my CD came out, it was being played. I got playlists from the different radio stations that was playing it. And I was shocked. It was on the top 40. A lot of them, and it it was because one DJ said it was because of the feeling that's in the CD, and he said especially the people don't understand the words. This is from a place in Europe. He said the people don't understand the words, but they understand the feeling, and they call every night and request that song, and it was America Our Union. The very first one that I wrote. And I wrote it because I felt it. And I tell everybody this story. My husband was probably the best speech maker ever. He never used a note. He just spoke from his heart. And that's what made the difference. And he knew what he was speaking about because he was involved in it. And, I mean, people have speech writers and all that stuff. Well, that's all right. But he knew what he was talking about. And he didn't have the numbers that he needed, and I looked them up for him one time and put them on a piece of paper, and he stuck them in his pocket, and they stayed there. He made that speech without using those numbers, and it was just as effective as if he'd had them. And so that's the way I'd like for my music to be looked at, you know, and listened to. They called me and asked me if they could use the song. They wanted to use one of my songs on it and asked me if they could. And I said, sure. Then they wanted me to sign over the rights to it to somebody else. And I said, no. No. I don't care if it never goes anywhere. I'm not going to register it with a company because that means they can give it to anybody they want to. And I really wrote that music for a specific purpose, a specific time. And One Day More, though, I think is timeless. I mean, you don't have to use that one verse that names Mark Rich and that verse. You don't have to use that. But the other verses that are there are just, they're universal. And that's what he said about the music. He said, that DJ said, this music is universal. It doesn't matter what language it's in. People know what it means.
And that's part of the original time. Maybe I'm specific to this, but universal, not to be
specific. Yeah. That's what I was trying to remember. When he wanted me to write that song, he said, make it individual enough so they know it's about them, but make it universal enough to so other people can use it in other struggles after this.
I think
we
want to get you to play one, but
okay.
Is there anything
No, just, if this is going to, I don't know who this is going to go out to, but if there's anybody listening to this or reading this, and you've got any idea that you can do anything, tell a story. Rick's a great storyteller. I used to love to listen to his Jack tales. And write a story about what you're going through. Tell it. Write it in a poem. Just put it on paper and try to put music to it, or we put it on paper and get somebody else to put music to it. Just get it out there. Just get it out there and let people know what you're thinking, and you'll be surprised how much it will free you up and help you out. Because it did me. It made a monster out of me.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well,